I'm keeping mine off today because I have an especially hormonal period this month, and so
Oh
my face
no.
is I don't want to even look at my face. Actually, now that I think about it, a hormonal period is like the perfect thing to
I
have while
mean,
we're talking about the garden.
that seems right. Yes.
This is like fate. This is why I had the hormonal period. It all makes sense. Oh my God.
I made it happen to you.
You did. Ugh. Welcome to I'm a Writer But. My guest today is Claire Beams. Claire Beams is the author of the novel The Illness Lesson, which was a New York Times Editor's Choice and was longlisted for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, and the story collection We Show What We Have Learned, which won the Bard Fiction Prize and was a finalist for the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize, the New York Public Library's Young Lions Fiction Award, and the Shirley Jackson Award. She was a finalist for the 2023 Joyce Carol Oates Prize and has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Breadloaf and Swanee Writers Conferences, McDowell, and the Sustainable Arts Foundation. She lives with her husband and two daughters in Pittsburgh and teaches in the Randolph College MFA program. Her new novel is The Garden, a page-turning and psychologically thrilling tale about the mysteries of the female body and the ways it has always been controlled and corralled. Welcome, Claire. I loved this book so much.
Oh,
I
thank
am,
you.
and also I love you so much, and I loved The Illness Lesson. I'm so happy that we're finally coming together to
I know. I
talk.
am so excited. I love this podcast so much. I
Oh.
listen to it all the time, like while I'm doing the dishes, like anytime I need like a little infusion of feeling like a writer while
Yes.
I'm, driving in the car forever. I mean, but it's just, I always come away with new ideas about things to, to try or to, I don't know. It just is really, it's really wonderful. So this is a great joy for
Oh,
me.
that makes me so happy because, that's what I was searching for. Well, mainly I
Yep.
was searching for like, hey, am I an idiot?
No,
Because I'm
you are not. It's the answer.
maybe not in this way.
Right, that's all we can hope for, one way in which we are not idiots.
Exactly. I am not alone.
Yes.
Usually I ask my participants to read. Would you like to read a
Yes.
little bit?
I would love to read. So I'm just going to read from the beginning because that way I don't have to explain anything. So this is just the first few pages of the garden. The house held still, and behind it, the garden rested, brown turning green. Doctor and doctor, Mr. and Mrs. came out onto the steps to watch the approach. They did this when they could. Welcome made a difference. Without turning to him, she said, "Remember not to talk too much," as if he ever did or could or wanted to when she was there. George and Irene drove toward the house that held their future and saw the doctor and doctor standing at the top of the main stair, right in the maw of the gaping door. That was the way things looked to Irene: the steps, the tongue, the portico, the brow, the facade, the wide marble face. George slowed the car just enough, Irene feared, to be noticed. "Jesus," he said, "what is this place? Why are they watching us like that? Speed up, they'll think we're afraid of them." "Renie, we are." Fear wasn't the feeling Irene had been aware of before this moment. But as the car neared and Irene kept an eye on the doctors, waiting for them to move, she understood that all along she'd been imagining a hospital, like the one where they'd met these doctors the first time. Instead, it seemed she had to face the mammoth, patient creature of this house, which was stationary, yes, but stationary like a living thing, holding still on purpose only until it could take her inside. Look, even its arms were extended, two long wings angled in, ready to close. And she had to face these complimentary doctors, too, fixed as the statues that flank entries. If it were Irene standing there with the woman doctor, the match would be nearer. "You look alike a little. Did you notice?" George had said to her after their first appointment. Irene had noticed only that feeling of hard-to-place familiarity that makes a person ask, "Do I know you from somewhere?" The doctor's eyes weighed, and Irene wondered how clearly they could see her and George through the windshield, and if the doctors could read lips. "You're really going to leave me here?" she said to George, trying not to move her mouth much. She meant it to sound playful, but to be here, they had both peddled themselves. George's forehead gathered. "No, it's all right," Irene said. They were close enough now to see smiles rising to the doctor's faces. George stopped the car and came around to Irene's door with the rollicking gait she loved. She put her hand in his so he could help her out. Every time he stewarded her lately, he seemed to be rubbing her face in his stupid hope when she had enough of her own. She climbed forth. She touched the slippery rose-colored fabric of her new maternity suit. This was the color she'd wanted right away from the catalog's many choices, warm and bloomy. "Good morning," the woman doctor called and descended the stairs to press George and Irene's joined hands. George broke his grip then to reach up the stairs and greet the man doctor, still a few steps up, as if sealing some bargain. "How was the drive?" asked the woman doctor. "I tried to take the corners slow, for her stomach," said George. "What a good sign," the woman doctor said. Irene peered into her face, not a perfect mirror, no, something similar about their chins and the hard set of their mouths, the lift of their eyebrows, but this woman's eyes were blue where Irene's were wheat-colored, and Irene's hair was darker. And, of course, the doctor was older, too. How old? Older than Irene's own age, 28, but much younger, she thought, than her mother. In that middle territory, what happened to a childless woman? Irene had begun finding out for herself. Kitchens and bedrooms and living rooms full of screaming quiet. Sun on carpets, rain on doorsteps, quiet so loud she could hear nothing else. But she wondered if for this woman doctor it might be different. "Very promising," said the man doctor. He had charm, but there wasn't much to wonder about him. The doctors led the Willards up. Stairs brought out the sluggish drag of the weight at Irene's center, and even here she didn't like this awareness, which had never led anywhere good before. Her body had over and over proven itself a liar. She'd started to suspect this might just be a new uncovering of a trait it had always had. As they fed themselves in, one by one, Irene had time to notice that up close the marble of the house was, in fact, veined, like skin. And I'll stop there.
You know, it wasn't until that, you reading that, that I realized that we get that first initial opening of the doctor's perspectives.
Yes, yes.
Oh
There are
my
a couple.
God.
Yeah. Well, and there used to be much more of Dr. Bishop's perspective. I wrote an entire draft of this book that was almost divided evenly between Irene and Dr. Bishop.
Wow.
I know. And I love Dr. Bishop and found her so interesting. But and it took, as it often does for me, it took my agent and editor being like, so every time we go into her head, we're like, you're like taking all the air out of the balloon of what you're doing, which was totally true. Like I really had this impulse every time we were with her to be like back in backstory and having her explain her motives for what she's doing and, you know, all the ways in which she's not a villain or she's an accidental villain. And I think I had to write that to know all that, but I think the reader doesn't, this really is, I think, a ghost story, and she was taking all the ghosts out of it.
But we do, you did preserve this opening little bit where
I
we
did.
see their dynamic.
And George gets a little tiny point of view at the end of the first
Yes.
chapter. And there
Yes.
are little moments throughout where the women giving birth get
Yes.
little moments of their own perspectives. Yeah.
Oh my God, I love that so much. And what I love so much about Dr. Bishop, because I was thinking to myself, is it okay that I really like her and that I kind of
Yes.
sympathize with her? And she's got this. So Dr. Bishop is someone who has this pioneering technology that, you know, supposedly helps women who've miscarried many times before, carry a pregnancy to term and have a healthy baby. Not always, but it seems
Right.
like this thing that she's doing is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But then she's also sort of, you know, got the blinders on when things aren't going well.
Absolutely, yes,
And
right.
and she's just kind of a weirdo,
Yes.
you know, like
Yes.
it's and the fact that we're questioning her motivations and we're kind of wondering like, well, this woman who's doesn't want children herself has dedicated her life to helping other women have children.
Right.
What's that about? You know, like and
Yes.
why isn't she paying attention to that? Was so fascinating to me.
Well, good. I'm glad that she doesn't read as just a simple villain. I do think that I am fascinated by characters who are doing great harm, even though they have good intentions. And that seems to be sort of like how the shape that my villains tend to take in at least at least in my novels. And I think that that is absolutely what's going on with her. And I think I wanted to write her perspective because I did want to sort of show all the ways in which she truly does have a sort of noble impulse. It's just that the way she's pursuing it is so single-minded. And so, like, she's just all in, no matter what transpires along the way. And that, I think, is where the sort of danger comes in.
Well, because she's dealing with a lot of the same things that the women are dealing with. First of all,
Right.
they're women.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
And,
Right.
you know,
Right.
like part of the problem, and it's persists to this day, is that pregnancy is viewed as this natural thing. And so we don't really need to pay attention to the complications or the pain or the discomfort or, you know,
Yep.
it's just kind of like, get over it. You know,
Yeah.
like women have
Yeah.
been doing this for millennia, you know, like, what
Yes.
are you complaining, you know? And those are things that we really should pay attention to. Women have known that forever, that we
Oh,
should be paying
exactly.
attention to these things. And then on the flip side, mirroring that is that she is a doctor. She's a female doctor in the 40s, you
Yep,
know,
yep.
and her husband has to legitimize her. He's just
Yep.
like a pretty face.
Yep.
And so
Yep, that's
they're
right.
kind of, there's this mirror that's happening, this like scream that no one can scream.
Yes. Oh, I love that. I love that. Well, and I think also like the same qualities that have enabled her to be what she is, a woman doctor in the 40s, of course she's single-minded and kind of all in. I mean, she would never have achieved what she's achieved if she weren't that way. But I think it's another thing that I think is just interesting to me is the ways in which people's strengths can kind of like turn against them or turn against their role in the world in certain ways. And so the same things that make her admirable also make her really scary. And the same becomes true of the women. But yeah, I mean, to go back to what you were saying a second ago, I mean, I think that right, there's this idea of pregnancy as sort of natural and almost like sacred in this way that means we shouldn't look at it too closely. We should just sort of let it happen. And as a result, we know so little about it, in ways that became very clear to me as a sort of anxious pregnant person. You know, with each of my pregnancies, like there was a weird little thing that they no one could really tell me what it meant. And I am an anxious person and I like to find things out. That usually makes me feel better. And this was like the first large time in my life where that tendency just did not help me at all because there just wasn't information. Like deliberately, there wasn't information was how it felt.
I feel like my tendency to Google every little thing
Yep.
started with pregnancy and right after my children were born, where it was
Me
just kind
too.
of like,
Yes,
right?
me too.
And that makes everything worse.
So much worse because you just find this like gaping hole of lack of knowledge. And then there are
Yes.
like anecdotal things where the same thing turned out to be catastrophically terrible or absolutely nothing. And so it just, and I think that I was someone that, like, I think the state of pregnancy was going to make me anxious anyway. I think like the hormones involved can affect people kind of in a variety of ways, but I can see looking back that I was like a little bonkers the whole time.
Well, yeah, and that's another thing. People don't really explain that. You know, like I
No.
one friend of mine tried to tell me, like, "Hey, you're going to lose your mind."
Right.
And I was like, "Get away from me." Like, what are you saying? You know, I don't
Right.
and nobody really explains like the power of your hormones, you know?
Yes.
Like we still don't understand how powerful they are and all the things that they affect.
Exactly. And why is it that we don't understand that? I think is sort of like the ultimate question that I was kind of exploring here. Because I think there's some of it's just, you know, the body is mysterious and there's still a lot we're learning. But some of it is also that I think for a very long time and to some extent still, there was this idea of like, we better not poke too much at that area of things because that's like sacred and unknowable and women can't handle information anyway. You know?
Right. And
So.
so much of what's happening now politically relies on that kind of ignorance and that kind of,
Exactly.
in one way, it's kind of like, oh, it's beautiful. It's a blind faith in our bodies, in our, you know, in our histories, but it's just also ignorance, you know,
Yes.
and that can't, that's not excusable.
Right. And a
It's
lot of
leading to a
harm
lot of pain.
can
Yes.
be done as a result, I think, you know. So yeah, so I think as is often the case, like I don't know that I think these things until I write about them and then I'm like, oh, so that's what I think about that. But yeah.
Did it come to you, like I think about my last novel, which I was, there was like this idea that I wanted to write about, which was like this toxic codependent parent-child relationship. And then this like this real crime that I heard about came to me, and I thought, oh my God, there's my chance. Were you already sort of thinking like, I really want to write about like what happens to, women who miscarry a lot of times, or and then, oh, I heard about this real doctor, this set of real doctors. This is my chance. Or like, how did this come about for you?
So I am not usually someone who starts from like a big idea and then like sort of works down to make a thing that can express that big idea. So I came across the seed, the real seed of this novel, which I then like completely messed and played with. But there was a real drug called diethylstilbestrol that was pioneered in the late 40s by a husband and wife doctor team to treat repeated miscarriage. And I came across that when I was actually researching possible alternate titles for my previous novel, The Illness Lesson, because
Wow.
the publishing house that was putting the book out in the UK was not, they weren't fans of the word illness. And so there was
Oh.
like this has happened to me every time with my books that there's this like 11th hour, like, is there a better title? And then we every time have ended up with my original title. But it's so I was like just scouring strange medical corners of the internet and came across, and this of course is set at like a the this drug was a much later time period's development than The Illness Lesson, but I just had clicked around and followed links and found this little seed, and I had never heard about that drug before, even though it was quite widely prescribed in this country for decades, after these doctors wrote their pioneering paper suggesting that this like very high dose of an artificial estrogen could maybe help with the swings of hormones that happen around the time of miscarriage, and that maybe that would be beneficial. And so I just was so interested in this husband and wife doctor team, and particularly the female half of that doctor team, and this idea of evening women out, which I think is always is like often kind of a warning sign that we're in kind of dangerous territory. And also just so this drug turns out to just cause really terrible health effects for especially like the female offspring of the women who took the drug, because it deforms and changes the formation in a lot of ways of the female reproductive tract of these babies in ways that aren't really evident until puberty for those children themselves. So it took a long time for people to understand that this drug was messing things up in that way, and it also increases risks of all kinds of cancers and things. And so I thought that was so, just horrifying, but also I was thinking about like what it must have been like to be involved in this research that I mean, presumably these doctors really truly believed they were helping, and then they lived long enough to watch this all kind of fall apart. And so I kind of like I wanted to take that seed and play with it. And then of course it turned out that really I wanted to do this because I wanted to talk about pregnancy. But I don't think I went into it with that idea that I have like something I want to say about pregnancy. I don't think I would have known that I had this to say until I said it in a certain way.
Did it feel like a catharsis, like an exorcism for you? Like, did it feel good to be, writing about these things?
It almost always does. Like, I'm almost always really horrified by some part of the process that I know I'm going to have to do. Like, there's always one scene that I just do not want to write. And then once I've written it, I always do feel because I think like ultimately the kind of harm that seems to be the kind that interests me is the kind that comes from not naming things, right? And not and kind of that deliberate unknowing. And so I think I always feel better when I say something in a certain way.
I read this while I had COVID.
Oh no.
So I was like, this was like the perfect thing to read in the like the well, I don't know. I guess I should ask you. So I felt like I was in this fever dream state, right? Like I
Well,
was
good.
foggy, and then I was entering a book that feels very much like when they're on the, the grounds of this house and in the garden itself, which has strange magical properties, dark magical properties. I was like, was Claire on ayahuasca when she wrote this? What the hell is happening? It was like you were tripping when you wrote this book. Can you talk a little bit about, like, I feel like you pushed yourself into this really amazing, like foggy, dreamy space. Like, can you talk a little bit about how you establish that?
I mean, so I think that so I'm glad that I'm glad that you felt that way reading it. I'm sorry that you were reading it with COVID. I'm sorry that you actually had a feverish state while you were, reading my fabricated feverish state. But I do think so I think actually I had to work for that feeling, and I don't think the first draft had enough of it. I think as a result of this divided perspective in lots of ways. But I think I am a writer who I love to play in this kind of liminal space between the like truly weird and impossible and reality. And I love to kind of slip around between the two states. But I think here I was sort of too close to, like, I hadn't gone far enough into the weird with the early draft. And so as soon as I talked to my agent and editor and understood that like really what they were asking of me was just to make it like more haunted, it was one of those things where like I don't think getting an edit like that ever feels awesome initially, because I'm always really just looking to be told like, excellent job, you are a genius. But then I know like if I sleep on it and in the morning I'm like excited to try it, I know that it's probably the right advice. And in this case, I did wake up and think like, wow, like if I kind of lost the weight of those Dr. Bishop perspective sections, what would I be able to do with Irene? And of course, because I then had to write like a missing half of a book, I had to make new things happen and new degrees of weirdness kind of emerged out of that, I think.
Was the garden in that original draft?
Oh,
The
yes. Yes, the
okay.
garden was there. It was just like we weren't, there were a lot of like we would get to the ghostliness and then we would kind of like revert back to Dr. Bishop's perspective. Like we just didn't go quite as far with it and we didn't spend as long in those visions.
Why do you think you had the impulse to make them, Irene and Dr. Bishop, resemble each other?
That was also a sort of later in the game thing. And I think it emerged around the time I knew I was losing Dr. Bishop's point of view. I think I became more interested in the ways in which they're similar over the course of the writing and revising process. I think because like I knew if I was getting rid of Dr. Bishop, I did want to make sure it wasn't possible for the reader to just like write her off entirely as an evil person, And so I thought sort of by like yoking her to Irene in this kind of way, that would kind of make the reader consider them as sort of like twins of a kind, I would make that harder, which is maybe a weird thing to say because Irene is a very polarizing character. Like there are people who like really don't like her. I just love her so much, and everything about her makes so much sense. I mean, I'm like, why would you not be full of rage in this situation? But I get that she's not like warm and fuzzy. But anyway, I think that probably it came partly out of that idea to just make sure that there was this that like if I wasn't going to give the chance for the perspectives themselves to echo, that I was kind of like highlighting for the reader that there was this similarity. And just, I think there's a cool creepiness to it, this idea of this like strange version of yourself kind of implementing this treatment upon you, is kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's that, but like is I don't know if it's that allows Irene to see things about Dr. Bishop's past, right? Because it doesn't seem like any of the other women see those things. It's
They
really just
don't.
Irene who like gets these glimpses, these really terrifying glimpses of
Yes.
Dr. Bishop's grandfather and her father and like just terrible things happening. And which is, I guess, a way for us to get more information about Dr. Bishop and kind of understand why she is the way she is. But you never fully, like, we never fully get to see, like we're given these like terrifying glimpses, and she's given these terrifying glimpses. She doesn't get to fully see either.
No.
And it's terrifying.
Yes, I wanted it to be. And I wanted it to
Yes.
be also like that you couldn't be entirely certain if this was all real. But I think that right, like I think that the kinship between them and the resemblance, like I think I want that all to feel of a piece with the fact that she's getting this kind of like weird psychic pipeline to Dr. Bishop's like subconscious in certain moments.
I'm glad that you brought up the fact that some people really don't connect with Irene and don't like her
Yes.
because, first of all, Irene doesn't give a shit. Okay. She doesn't care if you
She does not care. She's like, you can all feel however you want to feel.
Yeah, who cares? I am what I am. She
Right.
is so resistant to, so Dr. Bishop forces them all to also do talk therapy
Yes.
and to kind of lay on a couch while she takes notes and to like talk about their childhoods and you know, because they're the thought is like, you know, your stressors, your buried traumas might be making your body an inhospitable place for a baby, which
Right.
truly, truly terrible thing to say to someone who's miscarried many times.
Absolutely.
But Irene just jokes through the whole thing, you know, throws it in Dr. Bishop's face, never, ever participates.
Yes.
And, you know, there are times when I thought, like, what is she doing here? You
Yes.
know?
I
And
think
it,
she's thinking that too. Yeah.
yes. And like, and she refuses to think of her baby as a baby. It's the weight, you know, which is the way that you've structured the sections of the book as well, is sort of
Yes.
starts out as the weight and then it's the mouse.
Yep.
And then is it the possum after that? Or
I think
the...
it's the mouse and then the moth and then
Yes, that's right.
snake and then the possum. Yeah, right.
Yes. Yeah. So she never, ever lets herself. And at first you're kind of like, God. And then you realize how deep her pain is because
Yes.
she's miscarried so many times. She's, you know, she's witnessed what happens to your body, what happens to the fetus as you miscarry, and you realize like she cannot think of this as a baby until it is literally a baby.
Yes. Even as, and I think she's even coming to love it really deeply while she's still refusing to think of it as a baby.
Yes,
And also starting to have like really deep doubts about whether it will be a normal baby, you know, given everything that's been happening here. But yeah, I mean, so she, I mean, I think her character came out of my trying to feel what it would feel like to be her, in that like she does really, really want to have a baby. She mostly wants that because she desperately loves her husband and he desperately wants a baby. And she just like he's sort of her like one point of softness, and she has sort of built a whole life around trying to try. It's like the best part of her is trying to make him happy because she just thinks of him as this person who's so much better than she is in lots of ways. And this is like he's come back from war pretty messed up and wanting this one thing, and she just can't give it to him. And so I just like was trying to feel what the, you know, like what that would be like, and to just to be trying so hard to force something to happen that you know you have no control over. And then to have to go to this like very creepy, horrible place, and to have to kind of put up with whatever happens there because you have no other option. So I think like I built her out of trying to sort of feel what that would be like. I also just think she's naturally a sort of person that does not like rules. Like she, and I think probably again out of a pretty natural sense that the rules don't offer her very much. Like in her time and place, there's not that much that is available to her according to the sort of the rule book, really. So, you know, she can't quite like write her own way to a different, better, larger life, but she knows enough to feel mad that she's constrained the way she is. And then I think that sort of recent events have sort of made that worse and more extreme. But it also turned out to be just like such an important plot thing that she is the sort of person who's like, no, or like, of course I'm going to go in this forbidden place, because otherwise I think the whole book just would have been this. There is so much waiting in this
Oh
novel.
my
I
God,
mean, it's
yes.
just like it was such a disaster trying to figure out. I mean, because you have to make an entire pregnancy pass, and they're really not going to leave with like
Yep.
very few exceptions. And you have to make everybody's pregnancy pass. And then there turn out to be these like very concentrated 3-day periods where they're waiting to see what will happen to the stuff they've left in the garden. And so, like, I had to print out this calendar of 1948
Oh
and
my
like
God.
make sure that I was making time pass the right way and getting us all to the right weeks for various people to be able to deliver was just like, it was kind of a nightmare. And I think if we didn't have Irene going and like opening doors she's not supposed to open, it just would have been very hard to make the book move, I think.
Absolutely. You know, like we're kind of going like, Irene, what's wrong with you? Yes, go, go, go. Do it. Do
Right,
it. Do
right. She's like the only force of movement, really. I mean, not really. Also, their bodies are.
Yes,
And
yes.
Dr. Bishop is, but you don't have access to her plans, really. So
Right.
it's without Irene, everything would just be sort of like happening passively to these characters.
Well, I feel like at every point in the book, you absolutely insist upon the humanity of each character. You know,
Yeah.
like they're never going to sort of rest on their laurels and be a set, you know, like a tertiary whatever character kind of just be there to move the plot forward or whatever, be window dressing, you
Oh,
know. And
thank
I find that like the moment that you talked about earlier with George as he's driving away in the very beginning of the book, George drops off Irene at this place and he drives away and he's filled with relief.
Yes. Right. Right.
Which kind of like gets sets us off balance as a reader, right? Because we're kind of like, oh no, what is he going home to like have an affair? Is he going, what's going on here?
Yep.
But of course he's relieved. That place is creepy. You know, like it's a lot of pressure to be around your wife as she's going through her pregnancy for the sixth time, you know, and
Yeah.
you're hoping that it's and you just you never let us just kind of write anyone off.
I'm so happy to hear that because I think I really err on the side of doing that for a very long time. I am a writer who I really don't start with character. I start with like image and language somehow. You know, like I know I have something when there's this like picture in my mind that usually has some degree of strangeness to it, and I start getting excited about how I could describe that thing. So, and then I arrive at character often by like figuring out, you know, who could I put in conversation with this image in my head that would be like the worst for them, you know, like who would this be like particularly hard for, you know, whatever situation I can make emerge out of this. And so as a result, like especially secondary and tertiary characters, I just really shortchange them for a very long time. Like I see them exactly how my protagonist sees them for like full drafts sometimes. And it takes my own going back through and just like, but wait, why are they doing this? It's not just because they're awful, you know, even if my main character thinks they're awful. And sometimes it takes other people coming in and reading the thing and being like, why is this mother character so terrible? Like, you know, I don't know. I think I should write three more scenes to figure out why that might be. But so I'm really happy to hear because it did, they all ended up mattering to me really a lot by the end, including the other women that are just so annoying to Irene for time, but that she comes to really love, you know, as I think is often, although not always the case when we do get to know these people who initially we might sort of bristle at.
Absolutely, because I think what we're doing is we're bristling at things that remind us of ourselves, you know,
Exactly.
and we're kind of
Exactly.
like, oh, I got to deal with that.
Yep.
I listened
Yep.
to this podcast called Ruined, where they one of the hosts describes a horror movie to her co-host who hates horror movies and so refuses to watch any. And
Oh, wow.
so they she describes it plot point by plot point. And there's always a moment where there's a segment called Who Will Survive? So she asks her co-host, like, who do you think is going to survive this movie? And that is what
Oh
this
my
book
God.
felt like. It was like,
Yes.
who will survive? I don't know. You know, I really didn't know until the very end, you know, because it could have been any one of there's like three main women
Yep.
that there's Irene and then these two other women that she kind of goes around with and schemes with and, you know, doesn't get along with and does get along with. And I kept thinking like, I don't know. I don't know which one of these women, maybe they all will. Maybe none of them will. I don't know.
Yep.
It was truly like a horror movie.
Yes. Well, and I think it's so hard to even remember back because I was writing so much of this during you know, lockdown with my children, and then during like the long unstable period following, like they'd gone back to school, but you never knew when school would shut down again for, you know, an indefinite length of time. But I in the earliest draft, I am pretty sure no one died. And now, you know, not to give it away, but now someone does die,
Someone
and there's
does, yes.
also like some horror left over for the survivors too, you know. I think that was actually something else that emerged from talking to my early readers was this sense that like I'd created this feeling, and that was again part of like the leaning into horror that like we have to see this. I've established this sense that there's going to be a cost, and then I really liked them all, and I didn't want to do that to them.
Yeah, yes.
So, but sometimes the book, you know, kind of needs it.
You
So.
also give us like incredibly detailed descriptions of miscarriages. And I'm thinking specifically of one of Irene's miscarriages where she actually
Yeah.
sees her, you know,
Yes.
what she's thinking of as what could be the fetus and
Right.
its little eyes. And I thought that was crucial.
It feels that way to me too, and it's really early in the book. And so I think that like what I tell myself is that if someone is reading this who really like shouldn't be reading this, like if this is too triggering
Triggering.
a territory for them. Like they will know pretty quickly, you know, where like they will know that this is sort of not for them. I do often, like if I read that section, which I've done a couple times at various, you know, I teach for this low residency MFA program, and I have read that section there. And I do, when I'm reading it aloud, I do give an actual like content warning for it, just because I feel like I also feel like listening to something in like a public situation is perhaps different from reading it in a printed form where you can close the book at any time that you're sensing that, you know, you can tell what's coming. You can like half look at it and be like, nope. Whereas someone standing at the front of the room is not going to stop talking just because it's your, you know, so but yeah, it is. I mean, it feels important I think the reason that it feels like that needs to be in there to me is that like that's what's keeping her in this place, is this sense that if she leaves, that's very likely what's waiting for her. Because I think otherwise, why on earth would anybody stay here? I mean, this is terrible. You know, just waiting in this creepy old house
And the
while the
food is
doctors.
terrible. The
Yeah.
food is
Yeah,
awful.
terrible food. Like everything is terrible. It's just, you know, and these doctors are really they're trying out a very new thing on you. You know, it's not a great time. And so I think we do need this sense of what like the fear that is keeping her where she is, that like the only thing worse than staying would be leaving, you know.
You mentioned that this book owes itself in part to your love of The Secret Garden.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So like I think I mean, I loved The Secret Garden as a kid, and I've done a version of this with both of my novels, actually, where I take this like deeply loved childhood book and then like spin it into a super dark place. I kind of did the same thing with Little Women with The Illness Lesson. But so, I mean, as soon as I sort of had this idea, once I took this like small historical seed and started playing with like, what could I do with this? I pretty quickly understood that I was going to have to fictionalize things to put them all in this like isolated space, because that didn't happen in real life. They just sort of worked the study with this drug into their larger practice. And the woman in real life, Olive Watkins Smith, was not a physician. She was a researcher. Her husband was the physician, and they partnered with a bunch of other clinics and just kind of did studies in their existing practice. And there was no talk therapy component. So I sort of like took the seed and made it darker and stranger. And I kind of knew, as is often the case for the premises of my stuff, like you kind of have to put them off by themselves so the real world can't come in and be like, this is a bad idea. So I kind of knew I wanted to isolate them. And then I think there was something about like the space that I started imagining in my mind that reminded me of the Secret Garden. And then I started thinking about how that idea of like a walled garden has all kinds of, you know, woomy associations that could be kind of interesting to play with. So I reread The Secret Garden as an adult, which was a fascinating experience. So I think what I loved about it as a kid, I was very drawn to books that had like secret spaces that opened only for the protagonist, and they kind of just belonged to that child. I think because I was like really craving a space like that in my own life, where I wouldn't be, I was just like a very weird, quiet, bookish kid. And I loved this idea of this like alternate world where I could be powerful, you know? And so I had loved like all the hiddenness in that book, the garden, but then also like the cousin, Colin, is this whole like hidden child, this whole hidden wing of the house. When I reread it as an adult, I still love it, but it is a darker book than I had realized as a kid, or at least it is to me. There's this weird emphasis on like kind of like reforming or willing oneself into health. Like, because Mary, the protagonist of that book, is like this kind of like vicious, awful child at the beginning. Although, again,
Yes.
like, why on earth should she not be? Like, her parents have died in this fever in India, and
Right.
she's sent to live with this uncle she doesn't know in this like gloomy house. And so, like, over the course of the book, like, as she reforms her spirit, like and begins like eating better food, but also just like being nicer, like everything about her gets better. Like she starts looking better, she becomes like an actually beautiful child, as opposed to this like she's described as this like pinched, sallow little like unpleasant looking girl for the beginning. So it's like she kind of like fixes her spirit and her body follows, and that happens in a more extreme way with the cousin who like literally can't walk because he's so like sort of he's like wounded in spirit so terribly at the beginning. There seems to be nothing like medically that's actually keeping him, keeping him ill. It turns out to just be that like it's the treating of him as an ill person is making him ill. So there's this like strange and to me, I think kind of dark idea of like with enough willpower and like applying it in the right place, you can make yourself well again. And she was kind of reacting against a lot of ideas that were also disturbing and unsettling, ideas about the rest cure, and sort of that just like lying in one place can, and submitting yourself to all kinds of medical treatments can fix you. But anyway, I thought that idea of like reforming the like inner self to fix the outer self had also kind of interesting. It also felt like interesting territory to play in the territory of pregnancy, which is probably where some of the like talk cure ideas started for me with these doctors, and this idea of like fixing the maternal environment so that you can carry the pregnancy successfully.
I still, when my kids are sick, I think I've just got to open a window, just like they did in the Secret Garden.
Let in the fresh air. Everything will be great.
It's like that was so like formative for me
Me
because I
too.
loved the book and then I loved the movie that they made. I just and so yeah, like I remember thinking like, oh, he just needs to go outside, and I still have those thoughts.
Me too. Me too. And again, like they're not wrong thoughts. It's just like I think where I start to find them unsettling is like the burden of curing yourself that then rests on the sick person, right? This idea that like you have sort of done this to yourself in some way by allowing your like spirit to be sort of warped. And that I think is not great.
Yeah, it's like it's similar to what we've been talking about. Like it's just pregnancy, you know? Just do it correctly and you'll be fine.
Everything will be fine if you just do this right. Yeah, exactly.
Just listen. You know, and I think there is really something to what you said too about like how dark a book is completely lost on a child. Like they just take those kinds of
Absolutely.
things in stride.
Yes.
And you know, because I'm re-experiencing a lot of books alongside my 11-year-old who's a huge reader.
Me too. I also have an 11-year-old, and
Oh, what a
she's
fun
also a huge
age.
reader. She's not quite a reader the way that like I was obsessive, and probably because the rest of my life like wasn't working so well. And I think
Oh.
she reads a lot, like not quite the way. I mean, I had to like have a book everywhere I went so that I like wouldn't have to interact socially. She's doing a little better than I am
She
on
can
that
have
front.
conversations. Yeah.
Yeah, just a
Well, we
little.
always want our children to be better than us.
That's right. That's right. That's what we're going for.
But like he'll describe books that he's reading to me. And because I'm an adult and I kind of know, you know, like I'm thinking about what things mean, and I don't call this out to him or anything, but I'm like, wow, these things are just like he just takes them for granted. You know, he
Oh,
just like,
absolutely.
you
Yeah.
know, like
Well,
all
and you're.
those I survived books, or every kid in the I survived books, parents have died somehow, you know? And
Yes.
it's like, okay,
Yes.
so their parents have died and now they're living in New Orleans and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, wait, what?
Oh, and the parents die in so many children's stories because the parents
Yes.
get in the way of narrative. I mean, I guess it's like a little bit like what I was saying with Dr. Bishop. It's like parents take all the air out of everything because they come in and they're like, this is a bad plan,
Absolutely.
or
Yep.
like we're going home for nap time.
You're on your own.
Yeah, exactly. No, and I mean, I think like just it's the darker stuff that I missed, but also just like the broader meaning. Like I just wasn't thinking on that level. I was experiencing the story as I read it. So like, a book like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I completely missed that that was Christian allegory when I read it and loved it as a kid. I just loved the idea of this alternate world that could open up behind a wardrobe where you could go have like a whole different life. My mom is a retired minister and like
Oh,
knew enough
wow.
not to be like, isn't it interesting the things that are happening with
Yeah.
the lion? Does that remind you of anything? Like she knew, and I have turned out to not really be a religious person. And she always just gave me space to, she was so great about my reading as a kid. Like she's also a huge reader, reads as much as any writer I know. And was so great about like as soon as I'd sort of exhausted the kids section of the library, going and finding me books from the grown-up section that she thought would have like a good story for me. And as a result, I like, I read like The World According to Garp as like an 11 or 12
Oh
year
my
old. I was like,
gosh.
all these people are married, but they are having sex with other people.
Huh.
And there's that whole, I don't know, have you read that book? Okay, so like there's the scene where she bites off his penis in the driveway. That was like really, I mean, it was really an education.
And your mom had read that and let you read it at age
He
11?
didn't remember those parts as much, you
Got
know,
it. Okay.
which I get. Like, that's not really the takeaway. I mean, I guess it was for me as a 12-year-old, but like, you remember sort of like the feel of the story and the characters. And so, and you know, looking back, like, I think that's a great way to learn about stuff is books.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a
I
very
agree. I like in our little school library, they have to get permission slips if they're trying to get a book outside of their reading range, like their reading level. And I'm, you know, or like sometimes people that are volunteering there know me, so they text me and I'm like, of course they can check that book out. Of course they
Absolutely.
can. You know,
Yes.
like
Yes.
they know about bodies. It's okay. Like,
Yeah. And if they don't, like, this is a better, I mean, I guess to me, it goes back to the same idea that, like, you can close a book. Like, it's the images that you're making are in your own mind. So, like, it's not an image that's happening to you in the same way that seeing something on the screen might be. And so I think it is easier to get distance when you need it, and to sort of step away and make it happen at your own pace. And you're sort of providing all the tools to make it happen in a certain way, you know? So anyway, yeah, I mean, I feel like I learned a lot for the first time from books. And that seems to me like a very low stakes way to do a lot of that learning.
Yes, absolutely. I think when I was 11, I read Bram Stoker's Dracula and I had to
Oh my
read it
gosh.
with a dictionary because there was, you know, like words that I didn't, that, you know, like older words that we don't really use anymore. And I was just like determined to read this book,
It's
probably because the
very
movie was
odd.
coming out and I was like, I
Yes.
gotta know what this is about. But V.C. Andrews was like my Bible. I read every
Yeah.
V.C. Andrews book I could get my hands on. And when I
Right.
think about them, like there's so much like weird sex and incest and weirdness, but what I'm
Yes.
thinking, what I actually re remember is how creepy they were. Like
Yes.
the creepiness was the allure for me. And my mom, yeah, my parents were just like, yeah, whatever, you know, like read,
Oh,
it's okay,
exactly.
you
It was
know?
like a very free part of my life, which I think
Yes.
was really great.
Did your mom, is she aware of Marilynne Robinson's new book?
She is. I don't know if she's read it yet,
Okay.
but she loves her. So yeah.
Yes, it's her. It's Marilynne Robinson's reading of Genesis. Like that
Yes.
to me is, I can't wait to read that.
Yes, I know. I wonder what my mom almost went to grad school to become an Old Testament scholar instead of
Oh,
being a
wow.
minister. And so she, like, I think sometimes you know, a lot of what's like news to other people in some of these books is maybe like not as much news to her, you know.
Yeah,
But I
right.
think I'm sure she's still, but she does love Marilynne Robinson. I'm sure she will. I'm sure she will read it if she hasn't yet. I'll have to ask her. She's like, I don't know. I mean, it's like every week there's like three new books that she's read.
Wow.
Yeah,
Well, I
it's
feel like
amazing.
that is what's missing in our modern day ministers, pastors,
Yes, yes.
is it's about literature, it's about the written word, it's about reading, it's about,
Yes.
you know, and I feel like and not just reading the Bible, right? Like reading other things
Well, it's in
and
so much, and it's kind of the underpinnings of so much of like what's classically been considered the canon, you know.
Yes,
So it is
yes.
an interesting. No, and my mom, you know, is a very liberal minister and was always the kind of minister who sort of believed that like once it became clear that like this was not really going to be how my life was going to look. Like she's very much the sort of person who believes that like people find God in many places. And I think, you know, she's just kind of every once in a while she'll like wistfully ask if like, you sure you don't want to baptize your children? I'm like, we are very sure. And we love you very much.
Man, shout out to your mom because I think that's beautiful. I think that's beautiful to let people have the space to find their own
Yeah,
way.
she's great at that.
I think that can be hard sometimes. So I, good job, Claire's mom.
Yes, no, good job in many ways. Yeah, she's great.
When I was Googling you before this, I forgot that the illness lesson came out in February of 2020.
Sure did.
Oh my God. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
It wasn't great. So you know, I had my kids at that time were 3 and just turned 7. Tess turned 7 like the day of lockdown. As her
Oh.
birthday is March 13th, or sorry, March 13th.
Oh my God.
And so it really like I had put together this book tour, and you know, I have my first book was a story collection called "We Show What We Have Learned" with a small press called Lookout Books, and that was a wonderful experience. but a different experience than this was shaping up to be. Also because I was hugely pregnant when we Show What We Have Learned came out. So I did this book tour where I had to have like a chaperone all the time in case I gave birth. I was like, I was like 7.5 and then 8 months pregnant for
Oh
most
my
of that
God.
book tour. And so this was going to be my chance. It was a novel with a big press and I was going to do a book tour and they were funding parts of it. And so I had put together this book tour that was like very carefully in pieces so that I could be home in between, because I just felt like it was the kids were too little for me to really just check out for like 2 weeks at a time. And so as a result of that, I really got to do like the first third of what I was sort of supposed to do for that book. And I think it was just like, it was a hard time. People were actually reading a lot. Some people were reading a lot. But I think it was a hard time. Like if you were someone who was not already famous, you were someone who like people were going to have to go into a bookstore to hear about you. It was sort of hard that the bookstores were not open. So I think it just, I had sort of built up in my head what this was going to look like. And then it just, which is like how the pandemic was in a zillion ways for everybody, right? It just like no one could have anticipated what March of 2020 would look like, really. I did get two pretty normal weeks. I mean, I look back at pictures from my book launch, which was February 11th of 2020, and it was just like elbow to elbow people in
Wow. Oh my God. Can you
gathered in the
believe
room.
that?
No, it was not good. And people were crying, I remember thinking like, huh. But I just, it hadn't even occurred to me that it would develop on the scale that it developed to. Like, I think
No,
we're
no,
all
no.
sort of still like, oh, like cough, cough. Like, isn't that like, hope it's not COVID. Like, it was sort of like, it felt very distant still, which was stupid in retrospect. Like, there was enough to see that this was going to be a thing.
We had
But
our
I think
blinders on.
I just wasn't even thinking. And I was also so much in like, book launch, like Googling myself mode,
Oh my God, I just got out of that mode. Like
It's
it's
not a
I
great mode.
it sucks. It's
It's
really
not
it's
great.
yeah, it's
You know,
not
as
good for your head.
it's not good for your head. And I think like this time I'm trying to be a little more mindful of like, and I mean it like each time, it's so different each time. Cause I think like the first time you have a book come out, it's this feeling of like a lifelong dream is being achieved and now my life will change.
Oh, that's
And I
too
guess
real.
that like in certain ways it does, but it happens slowly and not like all at once in that kind of way. And so I think it's better to know that going into the launching of a book, but it's like hard to know what to put in the place of that expectation too, right? Like once you've been through it and know, and also like, my first book came out right before the election in 2016.
Oh my God.
Late
Okay,
October,
Claire,
20. I know, I'm a
what is
little
the
worried.
garden going to rot upon
I
us?
don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think probably it's not me doing it, but it has
No,
been
I think it's not.
fortunate timing, each time. So we shall see. There is like an eclipse happening right around.
That's true. The day before,
The day
right?
before. Yes, the day before. So, but maybe that'll be it, just a
That's
nice
it.
little celestial, just a little accent. And then
Yeah.
we can kind of move on. But yeah, I just I think that I really was feeling so much anticipation for that book and so much excitement. And then it was weird to have to sort of let go of that dream in the midst of this like actual tragedy that was happening that was obviously far more important. But then there was like this smaller sadness that I felt also like I just couldn't. Like I couldn't talk about with anyone because like it doesn't matter in the scheme of what was happening more broadly. But I did, spend 7 years writing that book.
Oh my God, you should get a redo.
I think for a long time I just didn't understand that it was going to be because when they shut things down for 2 weeks, I kept writing to my publicist like maybe we could get something on the books for right after.
Yes.
Like
Oh, I
let's
remember thinking the
see.
same way. I remember
I
I would count the
know.
days. I was like, okay, we're on day 10 of 14,
I can
and
do
at the end of
this.
this, that's it.
I know. And right, because even just the idea of like being home with my children in that kind of way for 2 weeks felt like, because I love my children very much, but I have always known that I need them to be somewhere else for part of the
Of course, you're normal.
day. I just like, I am not really built for like endless games of Barbie. And especially endless games of Barbie where I don't even get to like write the script, like I'm just there like doing what's handed to me by the, I mean, I don't know. It just is
Isn't that the most infuriating part? Because it's like,
Oh.
yes, okay, I'll play with you. And then it's like,
Yes.
Barbie's going to the store. No, it's not going to the store. It's
No,
like,
I
what?
know. And during like the most lockdown part of lockdown, my 3-year-old was obsessed with horses. And there was this game we had to play where we each had to be certain horses, but I wasn't allowed to use speech. They only could neigh.
Oh, that
And it
sounds
was really,
terrible.
I would set a timer and I would be like, I can do this for 10 minutes. And she would look at me and she'd be like, I know, mommy.
Just started telling my kids, like, yeah, that sounds like something you need to do with another kid. Like,
Oh,
you
I've
gotta.
always felt that way. But it just, that was a hard period because there weren't other kids I could offer her
Right.
except her
Yes.
sister, who is, our family is interesting because like all three of us are introverts, including my oldest child. So my husband and I are both like, the three of us are all very happy being kind of alone together, you know, like kind of doing our own thing and then coming together at times to like share a little bit from it and then going back and doing our own thing. Our younger daughter is just like truly an extrovert. Really does want to do whatever she's doing with other people.
Oh,
And yeah, in normal life, I feel like great. That's why you go to preschool. And
that's
so,
right,
you know,
exactly.
they will love your horse game there. But that time was tough because I just felt like I couldn't really ask my 7-year-old to do it either because she didn't want to either. And so it was a lot of like, I felt like I had to do a lot more playing than usual.
Under
Yeah,
duress.
it was weird. I'm hopeful that this book launch time will be a little more normal, knock on wood.
I'm
I'm literally
knocking on wood for you as
knocking
well.
on wood right now. I shouldn't have said it. I shouldn't have actually said it. I realized as I was saying it.
The third time's a charm.
Maybe,
You know?
maybe.
That's what
We'll
that's what
see.
this is. This is gonna break the curse.
Yeah, we
And then
will.
your
We will.
next novel will be called The Curse.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
Well, Claire, thank you so much. This has been a delight.
This has been so great. Thank you so much. I really do love this show so much.
Thank
So.
you. And the garden is incredible. If you want to feel like you have lost your mind and are like terrified and titillated and fascinated and in, then you're going to want to read The Garden, which comes out April 9th. Thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you so much, Lindsay.